Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Rehm while she's away on vacation. Concern about health risks to infants and children exposed to BPA has led a growing number of states and local jurisdictions to ban the chemical in baby bottles and children's drink containers. And BPA is under scrutiny by Congress, which begins hearings this week on the Toxic Substance Chemical Reform Act. The chemical industry and some researchers say limited exposure to BPA is safe. Joining us in the studio to talk about BPA, I have Ken Cook of the Environmental Working Group and Steve Henches of the American Chemistry Council. And from a studio at Wisconsin's WTMJ, Meg Kissinger, who's been covering a lot of these stories for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Welcome to you all. Thanks for being with us here on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you.
1-800-433-8850 is our phone number. drshow@wamu.org, as always, our email address. And if you have questions, if you have concerns, if you have experiences, give us a call. Join this conversation. We welcome your voice, as always, here on the Diane Rehm Show. Steve, let's start with the basics. What is BPA?
Well, BPA is a chemical, and it's used primarily to make two things, polycarbonate plastic, which is a clear, highly shatter-resistant material that you find in everything from eyeglass lenses to sports safety equipment. It's also used to make epoxy resins, which are used very widely as the protective coating on metal surfaces, most notably as they're almost universally used as the protective coating in most food and beverage cans. They protect the safety and integrity of food by preventing food from contamination.
And this chemical has been around a long time.
It has. It's been around in commercial practice for about 50 years or so, and it's been very widely used over the last several decades.
You mentioned that it's used in lots of different products. Probably almost anybody listening to us or even sitting here in the studio is in some contact with it because we're all wearing glasses to start with that. But the among the biggest concerns have been with products that can affect small children and babies, right? And a lot of the focus has been on baby bottles.
That's correct. And in the history of BPA, it's been around, as I said, for decades. It turns out it's one of the best tested substances. There's this enormous database, enormous scientific database on BPA. And so that question about safety of BPA, whether it's for infants or for anyone else, that question has really been addressed very thoroughly, very carefully with the science. And that science has been reviewed by many government bodies worldwide just in recent years. And they've all come to the conclusion that BPA, as it's used in products such as polycarbonate plastic and epoxy resins, that those products are safe for use based on the science.
Now, Ken Cook, at the Environmental Working Group, you came out with a study this week, received a fair amount of attention, saying that BPA, traces of BPA, significant traces, were found on these paper receipts. And you heard Steve describe its use in baby bottles or lenses. People were probably puzzled to say, why on paper? What did your study find?
Well, we were surprised, too. I mean, we heard about this use of BPA a few years ago, and we finally got around to doing some testing at a laboratory at the University of Missouri at Columbia, one of the leading researchers in the field. And basically what we did was we went to retail outlets of major companies and took samples of the receipts, sent it to the laboratory, and did a simple wipe test. And come to find out that very high levels of BPA relative to other sources that we know about, and again, that we know about, were coming off of the receipt. Now, we know that 93% of your listeners and 93% of the American public has this material in their blood. Steve and I will disagree on how thoroughly vetted this material has been and whether every government in the world that's looked at it feels it's safe in all its uses. We have a very different view of that. But what we discovered was two things. One, that it's obviously it's there. It can come off readily on your skin. Recent study indicated that it could be absorbed by the skin, but also could be absorbed if you put a receipt into your grocery bag, not too uncommon, and fell on some fresh produce and so forth. You, of course, will always want to wash produce, but nonetheless, there's a
not the only chemical that has come in contact with that fruit.
Yeah. No, of course not. And we also know that retail workers, according to CDC data, have elevated levels of BPA relative to other workers in their blood.
Now, for an ordinary consumer who's listening to us right now, why should she be concerned about this study? What are the implications of what you found?
Well, over the past 5 to 10 years, it's really been peeling back layers of the onion on BPA to find out basic things like exposure routes. I think that's why if you go to baby stores, as I happen to go to fairly frequently these days with a two-year-old, you see BPA-free listed on products in every aisle, including baby bottles. More and more parents have come to the conclusion that despite some government assurances, there's still some uncertainty. And in particular, our government has reopened the question of whether they feel that BPA, as it's now being used, is safe. They have extensive studies underway at both EPA and the Food and Drug Administration. The Canadian government, likewise, took some action recently. And many states are taking action. Notably, California's on the verge, we think, of taking BPA out of sippy cups and baby bottles and also formula cans. And people are worried about some of the effects we've seen in health studies, mostly animal studies, almost all of them animal studies. Cancer, prostate, breast cancer, developmental problems, sexual development problems, all kinds of impairment, brain impairments. Learning impairments. So it's a wide range of effects, and when you see that many effects in studies at fairly low doses, environmentally relevant doses, as they say, the kind of doses you'd encounter, the kind of doses we have in our blood, that's when regulatory agencies begin to say, well, perhaps we should take another look, and that's what's happening now in the U.S.
Steve, do you share Ken's feeling that there are alarming implications that consumers should be concerned about the kind of study they've just done?
We understand that consumers are going to be concerned or even alarmed about BPA. We read the headlines, too, and we use these products. But we don't think consumers really need to be alarmed, and here's why. We have to get back to the basics, to the science on BPA. And I want to touch on one thing just now, going back to something Ken said about how much BPA people are exposed to, going back to data from CDC, Centers for Disease Control. They've conducted very large-scale studies trying to understand how much BPA people are really exposed to. And what they found is that the levels are extraordinarily low. Typical level of BPA that a consumer is exposed to is more than 1,000 times below the safe intake level that has been set recently in Europe based on this large scientific database that we have. So the levels really are out there. Even from contact with thermal paper, from store receipts, those levels are extraordinarily low, far below levels that we need to be concerned about, far below levels that would be harmful.
Now, let me bring in Meg Kissinger, who has written a whole series of stories, which I've read, about this product and this chemical and also the FDA's handling of it. And Meg Kissinger, as you've got two gentlemen here with points of view, what's your independent, as an independent journalist, what's your take on the evidence here?
Well, our look at BPA really dealt with the government regulation of it and what studies they considered. And as Steve Hench has mentioned, there is a huge body of science out there growing by the day. A smart scientist would be studying BPA right now because of the demand for information on it. And what our stories involved was the very limited look, the extremely limited focus that the government had been taking on BPA, specifically when its first look at this involved two studies, both of which were paid for by American Chemistry Council, which represents the manufacturers of BPA. So it was a very limited look.
And your stories also raise the question about whether these regulatory agencies were really taking a truly independent look, right?
That's right. And over the course of a couple of years of reporting on this, we took great use of the open records laws and asked for correspondence between those federal regulators, the government scientists, and scientists from the American Chemistry Council, independent scientists as well, and found that at some point there was a lot of deference or preference given to the American Chemistry Council scientists, some inroads and some discussions that the independent scientists weren't given.
Steve, this fair criticism of how this has been handled?
Not entirely. I don't really agree with that at all. I think in regard to the studies that have been reviewed, there are hundreds, really thousands of studies. And if you go and look at the government reviews on BPA, look at the citation list, what they actually looked at, you'll find hundreds and even thousands of citations. So I don't think it's accurate at all to say that that FDA or other agencies have only looked at two industry studies. And by the way, those studies
But Meg Kissinger did uncover all sorts of emails which indicated a degree of collusion and collaboration that was quite significant. Isn't that fair?
Well, again, I don't think that's fair to characterize communication with the government as collusion. We have an obligation to communicate with our federal regulators. They're the agencies that regulate our products. We have to talk to them. We have to bring them information, and we do. We bring them information on studies that we conduct, and it's up to them to review it and make a decision, but we have an obligation to talk to them.
Ken Cook, you also mentioned the fact, and Meg has written about this as well, that whatever the science, the debate over the science, a number of jurisdictions are concerned enough to be acting, and that this is a whole other dimension here. Canada, you mentioned, has passed a law, and bring us up to date on that.
Well, it's changing really by the day, and Maryland took action on BPA. I think there's six states altogether now. If California takes action, and we've been working very closely with the Breast Cancer Fund and other organizations on that legislation, Physicians for Social Responsibility. That will, of course, be a huge market. Companies are changing, too. One of the things that came out in our study that we were very interested to find was something like 60% of the receipts didn't really have much BPA, if any, on them at all. And it turns out one of the largest receipt manufacturers in the United States,
Appleton
Paper, I think they're flourishing, probably even more so today, because they have a BPA-free paper. So it's good news.
Ken Cook is with the Environmental Working Group, Steve Henches, American Chemistry Council, Meg Kissinger, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. Give us a call. We have some lines open. Join our conversation on BPA. We're happy to have you. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane, and our subject this hour is BPA, the widely used chemical in plastics and other products that have been the subject of a good deal of study and controversy, including a new report by the Environmental Working Group and the presence of BPA on receipts, all those receipts you get from ATMs and other machines. And Ken Cook of the Environmental Working Group is with me. So is Steve Henches, who represents the American Chemistry Council, the makers of BPA. And from Wisconsin's WTMJ, Meg Kissinger, a reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, who has been doing a whole series of stories on this issue. And you can join our conversation at 1-800-433-8850 or drshow@wamu.org. And Meg, I want to bring you in. Ken was talking about how a number of jurisdictions, Canada, California, others, sufficiently concerned about this problem to start acting on their own without necessarily waiting for federal regulation. Can you help us with an understanding of the public attitude toward BPA? And why do you have a sense of why individual jurisdictions are moving on their own?
Sure. I know that there is concern, especially parents of young kids. I think that's where the greatest amount of attention is being paid. And so far, six states have banned BPA in baby bottles or sippy cups, food contact items for children under the age of three. That's where the science has shown the greatest concern. So they are taking charge. And actually, as Ken mentioned, you know, this began really manufacturers were the first. Companies like Toys R Us and Walmart, they early on decided to scale back the use of BPA or discontinue the use of BPA in baby bottles and sippy cups. And other companies have followed. Appleton Paper, as was noted, not even bothering to use BPA in their receipts anymore because they're anticipating the consumer groundswell.
And it sounds like it's almost now being used as a positive marketing tool. These companies are, as Ken mentioned, in the aisles of baby stores and other ways, that companies can see this as an advantage not to use BPA.
Absolutely.
If that's true, Steve Henches, why isn't there more of an effort by the chemical industry to say, we don't need this stuff? If we have alternatives, if the public is alarmed, if the science is causing some concerns, why is there a dissonance here?
Well, we understand consumers are alarmed. Again, we see the same information they do. But we have to, again, come back to the science. What BPA does for us is it creates products that have a lot of benefits, polycarbonate plastic, clear, very highly shatter resistant. Those are very important properties for many products. And so we have to then look at the science to determine whether those products are safe or not. We have to look at what the government agencies have to say about that science. And when we look at all of that, we come to a very reassuring conclusion about the safety of BPA, about the safety of polycarbonate products.
But why do you think so many companies like Appleton, like Toys R Us, are already moving away from this component? They're voting, in a sense, with their pocketbooks and their feet on this.
I don't think I can speak for them. You'd have to ask them why they do what they do. But I think, again, everybody knows this is a controversial material. And one way to avoid the controversy is to do something different.
Help us understand the regulatory system now, Ken. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, has some authority here. There have been attempts to get them to be more forceful in their regulation. There's, if I'm not mistaken, a lawsuit pending trying to push them to be more forceful. Update us on who in the government is paying attention here.
Well, it turns out everyone's paying attention now. The Natural Resources Defense Council, one of our premier environmental organizations, has filed a case against BPA with the Food and Drug Administration to ban it. But the FDA has its own studies underway and its own review of its regulatory apparatus to see if they're doing what they need to do about this chemical. They have concerns. EPA, its regulatory
Environmental Protection Agency,
I'm sorry, to drop into Washington speak, the Environmental Protection Agency is looking at BPA as a chemical of concern because of its jurisdiction regarding environmental exposure. And then Congress, in a bill that's just about to be launched and will be the subject of a hearing tomorrow.
I believe you're one of the witnesses.
I'll be testifying as well, a representative from Steve's organization, among others. BPA is listed in legislation specifically as a chemical to be given priority attention. So I think when consumers hear this and when companies hear this, they come to a question rather quickly. What do I do while the government's trying to make up its mind? There's all this concern. There's a robust scientific debate. Some of us think that the debate tilts against BPA's safety. Others feel otherwise. I think what happens in a situation like that is state legislators start deciding they want to take action on behalf of their constituents while the feds try and figure out what to do. I think members of Congress jump in and say, well, if EPA and FDA aren't moving quickly enough, maybe we should do something. We have the food safety bill. There's a major debate now over BPA. Senator Dianne Feinstein, who's a very serious customer in the U.S. Senate when it comes to making things happen, she has insisted that something be done in the food safety bill that's pending in the Senate now about BPA. So I think when people hear this, as Meg said, it begins to inform a lot of consumer decisions and company decisions.
And Meg, you have, as you mentioned earlier, you spent a lot of time sort of examining the regulatory environment at the FDA, how they make decisions, how they're influenced. Have they been moving too slowly, in your view? Are they now being pushed to be more aggressive? What's your best take here?
Well, they are being pushed to be more aggressive, that's for sure. And there are many hundreds of studies underway, and the spotlight is shining very brightly on the FDA right now because of that consumer concern. The focus of our stories has really been about the need for transparency in scrutinizing the safety of this chemical, and you could add any other chemical as well, but just, you know, what goes on behind the scenes, because this doesn't happen in a vacuum. There are a lot of interests at stake here, and that's, of course, you know, what the stated purpose of the FDA is, to protect the consumers, and that's what we're looking at.
Steve Henches, what's your take on the role of these two agencies, FDA and EPA, moving fast enough, not fast enough? I've been reading also that in some ways the chemical industry also has a stake, not only in producing the products using materials like BPA, but also you have a vested interest in convincing the public that these materials are safe. So in some ways, regulation works to your advantage as well as disadvantage.
I'd have to say that FDA, I think, has been fairly responsive. They've been really reviewing BPA for probably more than 10 years now, at least on an informal basis, and they've been reviewing it seriously over the last couple of years. Maybe more important, though, is that to answer a few open scientific questions, resolve some uncertainties, they've designed a very comprehensive research program that they're undertaking right now in their labs. It's very reassuring as we see the results that start to come out of that research. They're just starting to be published in the scientific literature now. And those results are actually very encouraging, very reassuring about the safety of BPA. So overall, I'd have to say FDA has been very responsive on this. They are moving along in a very comprehensive, thorough way.
Now, we have a lot of listeners, as you can well imagine, since this is a consumer-oriented subject, who want to join. And here's one email from Wesley in Miami, Florida. I'll read it. Many toxic substances are considered safe, but when we put them together, they become a toxic stew. Can the guest comment on this? Is this one of the issues with BPA? Does it combine with other chemicals?
Well, you know, if you look at the studies that are underway, I don't think there are probably any of them that are looking at BPA in combination with other chemicals. I could be wrong about that, Steve, but for the most part, we regulate chemicals one at a time. And we have found BPA in the umbilical cord blood of 10 minority babies we tested last year. So you're exposed to BPA before you even enter the world. And you're exposed to dozens and dozens and dozens of other chemicals at the same time. We never study those combinations to see what might be happening in combination. It's very difficult, very expensive to do. But the experiment's underway, if you will. I mean, the exposures are happening. We have very few controls, and so it's very difficult to step back and say at different dose levels, just testing two or three chemicals at the common levels we find them in, say, infants, is extremely difficult to do. So unfortunately, we have a system that allowed a lot of these chemicals to come on the marketplace before we thoroughly understood exposure pathways or potential toxicity. I mean, if, as Steve says, 10 years of FDA study, they're not studying this chemical because they're not concerned about it. They're studying it because there are important scientific questions that haven't been resolved, but it's in us. And so we hope the questions are resolved in a way that reduces liability for the companies that have been putting it out there. We hope that it turns out that they're not dangerous. We hope that maybe if they can continue using it, no one will be harmed. But we don't know.
Do you have a view of this, Steve, this question of the way chemicals interact to produce a different reaction than if a chemical is just studied separately?
That's, I think, a growing area of science. There is research underway to try to understand how chemicals can interact in the body, but that's very much a developing area of science. Looking at BPA specifically, I think it's probably the same as for any other chemical, most any other chemical. There aren't a lot of studies that look at mixtures, but we do know, I have to stress that we do know a lot about BPA. It has not been understudied. It certainly is one of the best tested substances out there. So we have a lot of reassuring data, starting with the level that people are exposed to, the way it's processed in the body, and this is really what FDA has been publishing recently. And then after that, a lot of comprehensive studies that give us reassurance about the safety of BPA.
Jonathan from Washington, D.C. writes, how does BPA break down in the environment? Could it be connected to the problems we're seeing in fish and amphibians? Yeah.
There's very similar to BPA in human health. There's also almost an equally large body of data on BPA in the environment. And here we have one very important thing that we do know quite well about BPA. It does not last long in the environment. It degrades quite rapidly. And the way that happens is that bacteria that are naturally present in the environment essentially eat BPA. They consume it and get rid of it. So the half-life for BPA in the environment is quite short.
Here's John in Dallas, Texas writes, "It's not that BPA concerns me. I believe the chemical industry when they say that exposure is safe at certain levels. The concerns I have is that the cumulative effect of the thousands of chemicals in our environment combined that our bodies are in contact with every day." This gets to the point you were raising, Ken. "One chemical may be safe at a certain level, but are there studies showing the effect of all the chemicals at once on our bodies?" Ken?
No. We're in the dark on that basic question, but one thing we've come to learn from the CDC studies, the biomonitoring studies we've been doing, the studies of pollution in people, and many other advocacy groups around the country have commissioned laboratory studies too. We know the mixtures are out there in our blood already, and they're in there before we enter the world. But as a matter of fact, we have no scientific basis for knowing whether or not it's safe.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let me read this note from Madeline in Baltimore, and Mae Kissinger, I'll give you the first part here. "Are there any real regulations of products that are labeled BPA-free? Is that just a marketing tool, or are there regulations?"
It's absolutely a marketing tool. There is no labeling requirement at all. So we've wondered about that. You know, just because something says it's BPA-free, is it really?
Your anecdotal studies, your journalistic studies, you have any sense of whether this actually is an appealing idea? Do people go into stores looking for this now? Is there a level of consciousness that where this is an effective marketing tool?
Yeah, that's what we're hearing, is consumers are looking for that sticker that says BPA-free, especially when it comes to food contact containers. So I think you're going to continue to see that.
Because we've been talking about, you know, of course, baby bottle sippy cups have been the major issue that a lot of people have focused on. But the second issue, Steve was pointing out that this is also used for these epoxy resins that are used to coat metal cans, the inner lining of metal cans, which help, in the view of the chemical industry, keep the food fresh and healthier. But there's also been concern about that chemical leaching into the food from the cans. Have you seen any cans or had any reports of cans that are labeled BPA-free?
I haven't personally, but I'm told that, and Steve Henches, you could answer this. I'm told that in Japan especially there are efforts at BPA-free cans. Is that true?
Either of you guys know that? Yeah.
In Japan, I think epoxy resins are used very similar to the way they're used here. They're in most food and beverage cans. In Japan, I understand there's one additional technology that they use that adds an additional coating on the cans. By and large, in Japanese food industry, they use epoxy resins as a can coating, very similar to the way we do.
Madeline had a second question. "Do any of the guests know much about exposure routes?" You were starting to talk about this, Ken. "Specifically, I'm a mother of an infant. I avoid feeding him foods from cans, bottles, and toys with BPA, but I'm wondering if I am exposed to BPA, if that exposure would transfer to him in breast milk. And also, as related to receipts, is a topical skin exposure the issue, or would the concern be more that of somehow oral intake?"
Well, as the father of an infant of a two-year-old, I can say that I've also driven myself fairly crazy trying to avoid BPA. It's getting easier to do it, but I certainly, for the food containers and the foods we give our child, we go out of our way to make sure that we aren't exposing him to BPA. Likewise, I mean, yes, the presumption would be that if you have been exposed to BPA and it's in your blood, and Steve's right, the half-lives can be fairly short in the environment, but you're getting a constant dose, so it's always there being replenished. That could transfer to your child, and that's a route that, of course, breastfeeding is the best way to feed an infant, and so we're not discouraging that one bit, but it is a concern. And as for the receipts, you know, we don't really know much about it. We can hypothesize that it could get through your skin if you've got a purse full of receipts. I know my wife has, and I have a wallet full of them. Yes, I'm concerned about how that might be transferred touching my mouth, touching my baby, feeding him, you know, picking up a binky and handing it to him. It's, you know,
are there Meg or any of you a growing sense of guidelines? Are there any consumer agencies starting to put out guidelines for parents? I'm sure a lot of people who are listening to us are saying, gee, maybe I didn't even think that much about it. Maybe I should be concerned. Meg, do you know of any?
It was so confusing at first, and we had so many emails and phone calls from people saying, what's going on? And we're hearing one thing from one agency and another thing from another. The FDA did do a pretty good job in January when it revised its assessment, saying that they did have some concern regarding BPA in infants and children. And they do, on their website, they do have some guidelines. So
it's the FDA website?
Yeah, what's your exposure.
What's the URL?
I guess it would be FDA.gov.
FDA.gov, so that folks who would like some guidance here would
if
be able
concerned,
to.
That's
if
right.
you're concerned, FDA.gov. Good advice. Thanks, Ken Cook, Steve Henches, Meg Kissinger, and I will be back with more of your comments and your calls. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
A new novel imagines the life of an Indian Muslim boy who rises from the slums of Mumbai to become the celebrated chef of a 3-star restaurant in Paris. A scrumptious tale of food, family, and destiny. The Diane Rehm Show next hour. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. And my subject this hour, the controversial chemical BPA, a recent study by the Environmental Working Group pointing out that it's been found on a lot of paper receipts you get from ATMs and other machines. Ken Cook of that organization is with me. So is Steve Henches of the American Chemistry Council and Meg Kissinger, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And Steve, here's an email from Elizabeth Petro. She's a PhD student at Johns Hopkins in biological chemistry. A couple of interesting questions. Could you please talk about the risks of BPA-free products?
Well, I'm not sure I can entirely.
Well, let me okay. Because she has some more specific. Wouldn't removing the BPA lining from canned food increase the risk of foodborne illness? Are there risks from the currently extremely popular stainless steel water bottles, which also have been marketed as an alternative to the clear plastic ones with BPA? So answer, Elizabeth, please.
I can give some answers to that. I think we have to. There's a couple parts to it that are very important. One is to think about why do we use BPA in the first place. And the example that you just mentioned there, BPA used to make epoxy resins used to protect the safety of canned foods and beverages. That's a very important attribute. We care a lot about food safety. And so the first question that comes up then is, well, what about the alternatives? Will they work as well? And the reason we use epoxy resins is because they work extremely well. And so the alternatives that we know about don't function as well. So we do have a risk that we, or the possibility that we're going to introduce a risk of foodborne illnesses if we switch to an alternative. Then there's the second question about the safety of the alternative. What do we know about it? And keep in mind that with BPA, we have a multi-decade safety track record. We have an enormous scientific database. We know a lot about it. Can we say the same thing about the alternatives? Probably not, given that none of them have been studied as well.
And by the way, another listener calls in, and we've been using the short version BPA, but someone, I'm sure more than one listener would like the full chemical name. So what is it?
That full chemical name is bisphenol A.
Bisphenol A, but known as universally as BPA.
Correct. Good.
What about this? These steel water bottles? We've actually gotten several emails and calls about them. They're very popular. They're often marketed as an alternative to Nalgene bottles and others that are made from this hard, clear plastic. What do you guys know about it, Ken?
Well, Nalgene has switched away from BPA, so they have taken that route and followed the marketplace. But it is...
So there are alternative chemicals that can be used to make that
yes,
product.
Yes, in that particular application. But there are so many applications, including ones I'm sure I'm not aware of. But in the food industry, I think the search is underway to see if they can't come up with something that's provides all of the benefits that you want to have in a can liner, but... does not have BPA's downsides. And also, I think this whole series of questions raises an important point. We need a regulatory framework so that we're not skipping from one chemical that we are worried about to another that we don't understand and hasn't met safety standards. And what Congress is debating now, and we need a legal change to do this, is a safety standard that would apply across the board to chemicals. So that if we take BPA off the market, what replaces it or taken out of certain applications would have to meet the same safety standards that BPA failed to meet in this particular instance, if that's the case.
Now, as you can well imagine, we have a lot of emailers who are taking issue, Steve, with your reassurances about the safety of BPA. A lot of them. And let me read... let me read at least one of them who writes in, chemical companies do have an obligation to communicate with the government. However, they currently do not have an obligation to test their chemicals before bringing them to market. The public is left with playing catch-up by paying for the studies to determine if there's a problem and paying for the cleanup if the testing reveals the problem. The companies make the profit. They should be required to test and reveal the results of the testing prior to marketing a chemical. This comes from a professor of public health at George Washington University, Jerome Paulson. I'm going to give everybody a chance to talk about this core question. And Steve, how do you meet the skeptics? I mean, you've got the FDA saying this chemical is of concern. You've got companies marketing. They're moving away from it. As Meg pointed out, there are a number of states considering regulations. You've got hearings on the Hill tomorrow. A lot of people are going to say, wait, there's a lot of concern here, and that your reassurances are not plausible. How do you answer those people?
Well, again, I think we have to bring it back to the science. That's ultimately where these questions are going to be answered. And for BPA, we know so much about it. I can tell you my personal view. I don't go out of my way at all to find anything that's BPA-free. I don't think this is something to be concerned about. I'm not personally concerned about it at all. And again,
if you had a 2-year-old, would you get or a 1-year-old, would you get a BPA-free bottle?
That might be all that's available right now, but I wouldn't seek that out. And here's why, because I'm looking at three things here. The levels of BPA that we're exposed to are extraordinarily low. We know what happens to BPA when it goes in the body. Again, coming from FDA's research that's just coming out now, very important research that shows that we are very able, including infants, very able to deactivate and eliminate BPA from the body. And there's quite a bit of data beyond that that shows that these extraordinarily low levels are safe. And then think about the alternatives. What do we know about them? Can we say the same things? Where I come out on it personally, based on those facts, not something I'm concerned about.
Ken, give us the other view.
Well, the other view is I think people have seen this movie before. They've seen industry defend lead in paint and gasoline to the last last moment until it was banned in both cases. PCBs, we were told that those were essential to have electricity. Turns out when we banned them, we still had an electrical grid. DDT, likewise. So I think people are used to the position of companies, and we can understand why. They've invested a lot of money. They've got some liability concerns. They feel the genuinely, many of them feel the products are safe, the chemicals are safe. They are not required to do rigorous testing in the case of industrial chemicals before they come on the market. That's the whole reason why we're having a debate in Congress now. The American Chemistry Council...
About toughening the standards.
Putting new ones in place. The American Chemistry Council, after decades of saying that the system is working and it's fine, a couple of years ago came to the table and said, you know, we do need to modernize this law. So everyone agrees that we haven't had an adequate safety net for this set of chemicals. We need to do something about it. And until we do, I think you're going to see, if you will, these makeshift accommodations where concerns arise about a chemical, markets begin to shift, and as a consequence, we're seeing changes take place outside of a regulatory framework that we really need to assure safety.
And if I may, the reporting requirements are a joke. Companies are given all manner of exemptions. We looked at certain chemicals that the names of the companies were blocked out, the formula of the chemical was blocked out, even the address of the companies where these chemicals were manufactured, and we're talking about large volume manufacture. So the consumer has very limited and in many cases no way to check out the safety of a chemical. You just have to rely on the company that makes it to provide that information.
Let's turn to some of our listeners who are anxious to join us. And Sherry in Northville, Michigan, is it?
Yes.
Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show. What's on your mind this morning?
Well, thank you very much. What's on my mind is BPA. I backed into this issue quite by accident as an essay topic looking into the proliferation of plastic into the food chain. So I didn't get too far before I got into bisphenol A and what that's all about. And one thing that has not been said is that bisphenol A was created in 1891 as an estrogen replacement. So that being said, you know, why is something created as an estrogen replacement in 1891 now currently in products and being debated like this? So the food safety issue, in my view, I don't think you can really dispute the fact that there's such concerns that it needs to be looked at. Thanks for doing that. One thing I did want to say and ask, people can get a lot of their own information, which I did, and I really encourage people to do that. Frederick Von Saal of the University of Minnesota is one of the preeminent researchers on this issue, and he is a non-biased researcher. His studies are really quite enlightening. And then finally, what I would just like to say is I totally support Senator Feinstein's effort. Talk about food safety. You can't really talk about it without talking about BPA. And I encourage Michigan voters to call Congressman Dingell and ask him to work with Senator Feinstein on this issue.
Thank you, Sherry. Appreciate it. Steve?
Well, I'll react to one part of it. I fully agree that consumers, if they're concerned, really should seek out information. There's a lot out there, but how do you know what's accurate, what's unbiased? That's a real challenge when there's so much information. And one point I'll make in regard to what the caller said about how BPA was initially developed, it was tested back in the 1930s. It was made back in the 1890s as a chemical. It was tested for its biological activity back in the 1930s, and it was never pursued for any purpose back then for a very simple reason. Its biological activity was way too low.
Let me bring in Lucy in Seven Hills, Ohio. Lucy, welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call. Thank you for doing a show about this. It's so very important. I started watching BPA 10 or 20 years ago. I had a filling. It's called a composite white filling, and it was I had two of them put in January of 1990. 2 weeks later, I had a miscarriage. I found out later BPA can cause miscarriages. Whether that's speculative or not, I don't know, but I just want to say thank you so much for doing this show. I've been watching BPA for 10 or 20 years, and I'm very concerned about cancer. I'm concerned about degenerative diseases, miscarriage, and not just children, but the entire population. Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and hang up and listen to what you have to say.
Thank you, Lucy. Ken, this is an area we have not mentioned at all, but I'm very glad Lucy brought it up, which is the use of BPA in dental procedures. Your reaction to her comment?
Well, and tie it into the previous caller. This is a chemical that at low levels, and Fred von Salen, it's the University of Missouri, just to clarify, is the his laboratory did our study of receipts. This is, again, another application where low levels of BPA, relatively low levels, are made available in the body, and as a consequence, some people may be adversely affected. Just because a substance is at a low level doesn't mean it's safe. And we always like to give the example of Cialis, which is a very well-known drug. It's active and can have profound therapeutic effects at 30 parts per billion, including profound side effects. So what you're talking about really is science that's emerged to understand these low-dose effects. Dr. von Saal is one of the dozens and dozens of researchers who have found them, where we really weren't looking at this chemical correctly. And that's what one of the reasons FDA and EPA...
What do you mean by not looking at it correctly?
Well, we were studying it using scientific norms, scientific processes that were ignoring and not detecting the low-dose effects. And because these chemicals have not been given, in our view, until relatively recently, independent scrutiny, a lot of the industry studies have shown that they're safe. The independent studies, when you stack them up next to one another, the independent studies show concern. The industry-funded studies pretty much universally show there's no problem.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We have time for one or two more callers, and let's go to Nancy in Nyack, New York. Welcome. You're on The Diane Rehm Show, Nancy.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to comment on the Appleton Papers BPA-free paper product they're touting.
Mm-hmm.
I have an email from Meg Kissinger where Appleton stated in December 2009 that they don't use BPA and they never have. And now they're saying in the Washington Post today they discontinued it in 2006. And I have a 22-year history with Appleton Paper. And they have a long, long history of lying, confusing the consumer and the government. As Meg mentioned, the government agencies. NIOSH has confidential business files, and they have public files. So if you want information on toxins, you're going to have the runaround, and you have to have a lot of money for expensive lawyers to get to the truth. And I'll take their comments off the air. Thanks.
Thanks, Nancy. Meg?
Yeah. That's that's frustration right there, and it is. There are uneven reporting requirements. It's confounding for consumers to know how to get information that they need to protect themselves.
And what would you suggest to our listeners or any consumer? You've written a lot about this, Meg, and I want to ask everybody this question. Where can people go? What can they do? Obviously, as our show has shown, there are conflicts on the science, but still people have legitimate concerns. What would you say to someone like Nancy, just from your reporting, not as an advocate, but as a reporter, what would you tell her or anybody who asked this question of you?
Well, there's a lot of information available on the internet, but there's a lot that's not, too. So that's what we just... Find as many studies as you can.
Any that you've found particularly useful?
Well, we're not scientists. I'm not
right.
A scientist. I'm. My concern again is what is the government's assessment? How even-handedly is the government taking a look at the safety of chemicals?
Right. Ken Cook, what would you say to Nancy and any other consumer calling in?
Well, we've certainly compiled, as one of the main groups that's worked on this chemical, we've certainly compiled a lot of both. Scientific reviews, policy analyses, and also a lot of consumer tips. So we would recommend going to our own website, ewg.org.
ewg.org. Okay.
ewg.org. And I'm sure Steve will have a website to recommend too in just a minute. But I don't know the history of Appleton Paper with respect to when they did it.
But in general, as a consumer, couple of tips that people should just follow is sensible.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all trying to eat fresher, healthier food. So if you can minimize canned food, that makes a lot of sense. If you have an infant, switched to, we use glass bottles whenever we can, except sometimes when we travel, if we're concerned, we use a BPA-free bottle. Likewise, we steer away from, our son had to use infant formula. We try and steer away from canned ones. Lots of tips on our website that you can follow.
Final quick word, Steve Hedges.
Well, I'd say there's a lot of information out there. It's very hard to sort through it. What I would suggest is looking to the experts who have reviewed that science, and FDA is a good one. FDA.gov is a good place to go. They have some guidance for consumers who are concerned. There are things consumers can do if they're concerned, and you can find it on their website.
Thank you very much. That has to be the last word. Steve Hentges is the Senior Director of the Polycarbonate BPA Global Group at the American Chemistry Council. Ken Cook is President of the Environmental Working Group. Meg Kissinger is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thank you all for being on the Diane Rehm Show. Thanks to all of our listeners who emailed and called as well. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane while she's on my away on vacation. And we really appreciate your spending an hour with us this morning.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones.